Today is Tuesday, March 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. There are people working around the clock combating COVID-19.
But it's unlikely that this virus will disappear next week or even next month.
Plus, what lessons should we be learning from the pandemic?
That's a two-part question, and the first part is, what should we learn now? And the second part would be, how can we better prepare?
We will have those stories and more. They're all coming up next. An official from the World Health Organization said Tuesday that the outbreak of the novel coronavirus around the world will not stop anytime soon, and countries need to step up to slow down virus transmission.
We still don't know how long this COVID-19 fight will continue. There are people around the world, 24 hours, 7 days, they're doing their best to fight with this COVID-19. But it's unlikely that this virus will disappear next week or even next month.
Takeshi Kasei is the WHO's regional director for the Western Pacific, and he said during a virtual news conference that there is still no specific treatment or vaccines available against COVID-19.
We recognize that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to preparing for and responding to an emergency like this. But we have found common tactics in these countries. Those are finding, isolating, and testing cases early, tracing and quarantining contacts quickly, and putting in place multiple public health interventions to increase physical distance between people to slow and stop transmissions, and mobilizing and engaging every community to protect themselves and the most vulnerable.
The number of COVID-19 cases worldwide has surpassed 800,000, and it has killed more than 39,000, with the United States, Italy, and Spain overtaking the case count in mainland China, where the virus originated in late 2019. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is pleading for medical volunteers to step forward as the state's coronavirus death toll topped 1,200. The AP's Sagar Magani has more.
Please come help us in New York now.
Cuomo calls the deaths staggering and says the state needs an additional 1 million healthcare workers. About 2 of every 3 Americans live in 33 states where governors have either recommended they stay home or, like with Ralph Northam in Virginia, forced them to.
To date, this has been a suggestion to Virginians. Today, it's an order.
It's the same in neighboring Maryland and here in the nation's capital, where President Trump said every American has a role in fighting the virus.
Our future is in our own hands.
The president says people who can really should stay home through April.
This is a very vital 30 days.
With every American having a role in fighting the virus.
The choices and sacrifices we make will determine the fate of this virus.
New Orleans, Detroit, and other cities are now seeing alarming clusters of a virus blamed for more than 3,000 deaths nationwide, though the vast majority of people who get it recover. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Food and Drug Administration on Sunday issued an emergency authorization for experimental coronavirus treatments using chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. U.S. President Donald Trump has touted the anti-malaria drugs despite inconclusive clinical proof of their effectiveness. The Department of Health and Human Services said hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine products can be distributed and prescribed by doctors to hospitalize teen and adult patients with COVID-19 as appropriate when a clinical trial is not available or feasible. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with Dr. Talal Nsouli, clinical professor of allergy and immunology at Georgetown University and research scientist at its International Center for Immunology Studies. They discussed under what circumstances the drugs can be used.
Everybody's talking about the anti-malaria medication that showed possible efficacy against the coronavirus. There are numerous studies that were done showing the efficacy of the plaquenil, the brand name, the chemical name is hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, against the coronavirus 19. A study that was published in China about 1.5 months ago, they took 100 patients that were suffering with the coronavirus and they gave them chloroquine. 70% of these patients improved tremendously. The viral load decreased, they felt much better, and they were able to improve compared to the control group. Recently in France, in Marseille, Professor Philippe Baudet and his colleagues, they did a study on 20 patients with the coronavirus. 10 patients declined to receive the hydroxychloroquine, which is the plaquenil, and the rest of the patients, 10 patients, did agree to receive the medication. So they used the people that declined to be treated, they used them as a control group and to see what's their outcome versus the outcome of the people that received the active medication and to compare the difference. So what they noticed, something very interesting, that patients that were receiving hydroxychloroquine, the anti-malaria medication, at day number 6, their nasal secretions was totally clear and the throat was clear from any coronavirus. When they started, they had coronavirus in the nose, in the throat, all over. The control group that refused to take the medication, all of them had tremendous thousands of colonies of the virus in the nose and in the throat. So they concluded that this medication could be effective. Let me go back a little bit. They added to this medication azithromycin, which is the Z-Pak, very often used for respiratory tract infection. So azithromycin was added to that. And when they added the azithromycin, they had an amplification of the improvement that was seen with hydroxychloroquine. When they added the azithromycin, probably was 30 to 40% quicker improvement and more beneficial effect than using only the hydroxychloroquine. So the authors concluded the combination of hydroxychloroquine, plaquenil, and the azithromycin, Z-Pak, could be considered in the treatment of patients with the coronavirus 19. However, the study was done on a very small number of patients, very limited. So it does not really translate to real life. However, the study gave us, it could be the tip of the iceberg, that we found a possible treatment, but still a little bit open to debate because the number of patients was small. Number two, these two medications should be used very cautiously in patients that do have heart problems, such as arrhythmias, AFib, and others, because they can cause severe heart arrhythmias. It means can affect the functioning of the heart and can even kill someone if the person has heart problem. And the fact that the two medications independently, the azithromycin, can cause heart problems in some patients, and hydroxychloroquine also can cause arrhythmias. So this is the electricity in the heart that can get affected and can cause abnormal heartbeat, if you wish. Palpitations, and the palpitations can become very serious, and someone can have a complete cardiac arrest. So therefore, these people have to be very careful if they're going to be receiving these medications. Number three observation, I think for the time being, we have to be sure that we never take them as a preventative treatment, number one. Number two, as we never take them if we are diagnosed with the coronavirus. And number three, they should be, I think, administered if someone is seriously sick with the coronavirus. So we have to understand that these medications are to be taken seriously, should not be used in any way to prevent the problem, should not be used in any way unless the patient is prescribed these medications in the hospital by a physician who is treating coronavirus, and to be sure that this patient doesn't have a pre-existing cardiac condition such as arrhythmias, abnormal heartbeat called AFib, and things of that nature.
Dr. Talal Unsouly is a clinical professor of allergy and immunology at Georgetown University. He spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawy. Ford Motor Company said on Monday it will produce 50,000 ventilators over the next 100 days at a plant in Michigan in cooperation with General Electric's healthcare unit. Ford said that it can build 30,000 units per month as needed to treat patients affected with the coronavirus. The simplified ventilator design relies on air pressure without the need for electricity. Strict measures to try and slow the spread of COVID-19 came into force in Australia Tuesday. Public gatherings of just two people are now permitted, and the authorities say that the police will actively enforce those measures. Phil Mercer reports that Australia has also announced the biggest spending program in its history to help protect businesses from the crisis.
Two's company, but three is now a crime in Australia. On-the-spot fines could be issued to those who flout new social gathering regulations. There are potential penalties too for anyone leaving their home without a reasonable excuse. Enforcing the restrictions will vary across Australia's states and territories. The New South Wales State Premier is Gladys Berejiklian.
If you need to work, of course you need to leave the house. If you need to buy essentials, of course you need to leave the house or get medical attention. Or if you're doing your exercise, they're acceptable reasons to leave the house. But beyond that, nobody should be really leaving the house. You can't just socialise as you used to. That's not allowed anymore. All of us have to adjust.
Authorities in the Northern Territory are warning Australians from other parts of the country to stay away or be forced to pay for mandatory quarantine. In Western Australia, cruise ship passengers are being placed into isolation on a tourist island off the city of Perth. Pubs, gyms, cafes and beaches have closed as COVID-19 forces much of Australia to grind to a halt. The government has announced an unprecedented $80 billion package to protect the jobs of 6 million workers. It's the third major stimulus measure so far as the authorities try to limit the economic damage of the pandemic. In total, direct government spending on workers and businesses now stands at around $130 billion. Ministers say the debt will take generations to pay off. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And coming up later...
Greek counterterrorism forces say they arrested the 23-year-old Iranian national in central Athens after he posted a call for an armed insurrection on a website.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The Spanish flu 100 years ago was the most deadly global pandemic in modern times. The disease resulted in about 50 million deaths. While the world is still grappling with the COVID-19 pandemic, I spoke to San Francisco-based internal medicine physician Runjun Misra about what lessons society should be paying close attention to in order to be better prepared in the future.
What should we learn now? I think that one of the main things is that mandates need to be followed very vigilantly and not halfway. And by that, I mean, if we're being told, like we were talking earlier, to stay at home and shelter in place, we really need to follow that. This is not a time to congregate outside. This is not a time to have social gatherings. We need to stay at home so that we try to stop and limit, you know, the rate of the spread. I think federal and state governments should be sending out similar messages. I know that there's a lot of confusion because national government is saying something else. There are state governments who are following, you know, different guidelines. But I think if all of us were on the same page and we were getting the same messages, people would be behaving a little differently. I think it's important to mobilize resources faster if we have the opportunity to do so, because I think that that can provide very valuable equipment to people, you know, to first responders that we need so badly. And I think given the lag in testing that we had for about a month that required CDC verification, it would really, really help to allow the private sector to help out earlier when we know that would be of a great asset to us. I think one of the things that we need to also learn is that social distancing is going to be part of our foreseeable future. This is not just a temporary fix, because what we're anticipating is that these coronavirus surges are going to happen kind of in a cyclic pattern. And those peaks that we're going to have are probably going to be smaller, you know, as time progresses, and they're going to be a shorter duration. But we need to understand that once a particular state hits their peak, it's not like overnight things are just going to go back to normal. This is something that we're going to probably have to implement on and off as the year progresses. And I think one of the biggest things that we have to, you know, think about and remember about, and I talk to my patients every day about this, is that if there were a vaccine for coronavirus right now, would you get it? And 100% across the board, the answer is yes. And the important thing that you can take away from that is that anywhere where there's a vaccine present for a disease that's preventable, where death rates can be lowered with, you know, future herd immunity, we need to be responsible as citizens of this country, as citizens of this world, to get that vaccine. The other things that I think are very important is that we need to support our scientific community with any means possible, because these are the people who are going to be educating us about how to move forth in any kind of situation where, you know, a virus or a bacteria is concerned. And these are the people we need to look for guidance. If we don't have enough funding, you know, for the scientific community, or for example, for the pandemic response team, that's going to be a problem in the future, like it was this year, because we just don't have a set group of individuals who have been working to ensure something that, like this doesn't happen out of control. And I think it's very important to make sure that both those sets of people are adequately funded and supported.
Runjan Misra is an internal medicine doctor based out of San Francisco, California. On Monday, Hungary's parliament granted Prime Minister Viktor Orban with the ability to rule by unilateral decree for an indefinite period of time to fight the coronavirus outbreak. The country's opposition, along with rights groups and journalists, have cried foul, saying the move may be used to target them. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with journalist Zabolcs Panyi in Budapest.
Viktor Orban has been in power since 2010, and he has a two-third supermajority in parliament. And that should be enough for him to, you know, have all the powers to fight the coronavirus epidemic. But he says that since this is a state of emergency, he needed the parliament's approval to hand him basically extraordinary powers for an indefinite period of time, which would include the power to rule by government decrees, meaning that he can pass laws, he can repeal laws, he can modify existing laws without parliamentary approval. He does have a two-third majority in parliament. He can do anything with the MPs sitting there. But the fear is that this virus will be so serious that lots of his own parliamentarians will fall ill. So in case the parliament is not able to fulfill its duty, he wanted to ensure that he has the same powers.
How are opposition parties, civil society leaders, rights activists, how are they reacting to this?
So this government has a track record of cracking down on the free media and on civil society. So, of course, all the opposition parties and most of the NGOs were quite worried that the government will use its extra powers against them again. In this new emergency law, there's a paragraph that says that anyone who's intentionally spreading false news or distorting truth in a way that is detrimental to the government's measures trying to fight the coronavirus, so anyone who does that can be punished with a maximum of 5 years jail time. But the law is very vague. So what is a distortion of truth? Is it a distortion of truth if I disclose different figures of casualties than the government does? We had a shortage of face masks. Our healthcare system is quite run down. It's underfunded. If we report on these facts, then are we committing a crime according to this new law? This might have a chilling effect on media outlets.
What about in terms of reaction from other European Union member states?
So the member states are quite preoccupied with their own situation, so they are not really vocal about what's going on in other countries. But the European Commission, basically the leadership of the European Union, has been criticizing these moves. They were saying that, of course, every government has to do its job in order to protect its citizens, but these should be in line with European values and with European laws. So there's some concern, but our government is basically pushing back on these, saying that the European Union is unable to give actual help to member states like Hungary, and instead of getting protective equipment from other member states, they need to buy everything from China. So basically their argument is that this is not the time to think about theoretical legal questions regarding this law. This is a time to save lives. And if you cannot help us, then please don't hinder our efforts trying to protect the people.
How valid is this argument about needing these extra powers in order to fight this disease.
That's what no one understands, because the government already has much more power than any other European Union member state. No other European Union member is taking similar measures. In the Philippines, the president of the Philippines, Duterte, came up with a similar idea to have state of emergency situation for a period of time, which will be decided by him when it ends. That's the only example I can give. There are no similar examples inside the European Union.
That was Zabolcs Panyi, a journalist in Budapest, speaking to our own Jason Patinkin. In Greece, the case of an Iranian migrant now jailed on charges of inciting an insurrection is highlighting the Greek government's rising concerns about a flare-up of clashes involving migrants along Greece's border with Turkey. Greek authorities say the Iranian man, a self-described anarchist, was urging groups in Greece to arm asylum seekers trying to enter Europe from Turkey. As Antti Karasava reports from Athens, the man, if convicted, faces up to 10 years in prison.
Greek counterterrorism forces say they arrested the 23-year-old Iranian national in central Athens after he posted a call for an armed insurrection on a website that is often visited by homegrown extremists and urban guerrilla groupings. Authorities say the unidentified man describes himself as a migrant anarchist, and they say he has not denied the criminal charges set against him, among the stiffest slapped on a migrant in recent years. Greek intelligence officials say Greece granted the man political asylum 3 years ago, and that he has since then established a militant profile linking up with far-left extremist groups in Greece. Left-wing groups in Greece have long supported asylum seekers, advocating their safe passage and their right to stay in Europe. But in his online calling, the Iranian went a step further, urging anarchists to help armed migrants take to the streets and renew clashes with authorities in northern Greece to help tens of thousands trapped in Turkey stream into Europe. Authorities in Athens say they have not established links between that plot and Turkey. But the Iranian's arrest here and the severity of the charges laid against him underscore Greece's desperate bid to stamp out any potential flare-up of migrant clashes along the country's borders with Turkey. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan flung open the borders to migrants heading for Europe in late February, after dozens of Turkish soldiers were killed in an air raid in Syria. Turkey last week said it moved 5,800 migrants away from the border crossing at Edirne province, where they had been massing, citing concerns over the threat of coronavirus. The move was interpreted by some in Greece as a reversal by Ankara, but Turkish Interior Minister Süleyman Soylu told an independent broadcaster the move did not represent a policy change. Once the COVID-19 crisis is over, he said, the Turkish government will not block migrants from returning to the border. Although Greek authorities have not established a link between the Iranian migrant and the Turkish government, they worry about how Ankara may use the nearly 4 million Syrian refugees now in Turkey. Ioannis Mazis, an international relations analyst in Athens, says Greece has already seen Turkey using tens of thousands of migrants as pawns in the recent border clashes. He says the Turkish government has even admitted that it has orchestrated much of the border violence. So threats of further clashes, Mazis says, should not be underestimated. By some accounts, as many as 150,000 migrants and refugees tried to push into Greece last month. Greece says it succeeded in fending off more than 50,000, while many others managed to sneak in. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.